Welcome to The Connection, where humans and aliens converse and where all the dots are connected. I'm Nancy of Zeta Talk, an emissary for aliens from Zeta Reticuli. They are here to warn of great cataclysms on Earth and advise how to survive this. The pending pole shift is not the end. Man will make his next leap forward to live a better time when aliens will live among us. I'd like to welcome Tim, who lives in Maryland and is someone who has taken the Earth changes seriously for a number of years and done a lot of research on a number of issues: underground housing, wastewater treatment, methane gas, wood gas, and I gather a lot of other little subjects for his own use. Welcome, Tim.
Well, thank you, Nancy.
I'm very curious about wastewater treatment, which is something most people don't want to think about. We've talked about the old-fashioned outhouse out in the field. Maybe you can move the outhouse along the corn row, you know, to spread it out or and the like. But many people point out that this is good fertilizer if processed in some way. At the same token, there's problems with it because some of the Asian countries or where they use human sewage in fields spread hepatitis. Isn't that true?
Oh, yeah. But it depends really on, how you settle, the effluent. When it comes out, you've got to let it process and you've got to let it do its thing.
Well, do you build like an effluent pond? I've heard it described that bulrushes and some plants do a great job in cleaning up an effluent pond. The water flow eventually flows off and it becomes pretty clean. I guess that's what most sewage treatment plants are, is letting it settle out. And then after a while, they drain the pond and scrape everything else up, and that becomes fertilizer, right?
Yeah, and they over there in the Asian countries, they really don't have a lot of that, I guess you'd call it technology, way out in the boonies. And the thing though that you'd really want to capture out of a waste treatment system is the methane. That's the one big item that is kind of overlooked. And if you do the proper steps and in your design of your underground home or dome home or whatever you're planning to do, you should always put a methane generator as part of the design.
Are you talking about a composting toilet?
No, I'm not. What I'm talking about is actually you're going to build a container, not really unlike just a regular sewage tank, but you have to build in ways of stirring it because, for a while it has to be kind of stirred every day, and you kind of stir up the slurry, and that helps with the biological action when you get the anaerobic bacteria really moving. And, at that point you can add clippings from the garden or from the yard or wherever. You can even add cow manure, chicken manure, things like that to get it really hot. If you were to really think about it, you could even put coils that would run hot water through. You could put coils down in this mix because it would generate its own heat, and you could actually run hot water. You'd have methane sort of powered hot water without even using the methane, which is kind of a good idea, really.
Well, if you're collecting the methane gas and you're throwing things like yard clippings and chicken poo and things in, doesn't gas escape when you're opening it up to throw stuff in?
No, well, it will a little bit. But, typically it's going to depend on how you design your opening and to drop the stuff in. You're going to want it to have like a little chute that you can kind of stuff it in, but it really doesn't, the gas really doesn't escape that easy. It's going to lose some. But then again, a good generator is going to really make that up fast. And you'd be really surprised at even a small one made out of a 55-gallon drum can generate enough to run a small gasoline-powered engine.
Wow.
For quite a little while.
Well, methane gas rises, and it goes into the upper atmosphere. So presumably, in any kind of a drum that you have, it's toward the top where you could have like a leach it off, you know, through a little pipe or something like that. So if you have a 55-gallon drum, what do you do to that to be able to stir it up?
Well, you know, on top of a 55-gallon drum, you've got two holes. One of them's about 3/4 inches in size, and the other one's about 2.5 inches in size. On the smaller one, you know, that's where you would actually take off your gas. Just hook up a couple of brass fittings and maybe some copper tubing, and you could run that to a little stove, a little gas-powered stove or something like that. And the larger end would be where you would actually put, you know, your clippings and your poo and all that kind of stuff. It would also be the area where you'd have to stick a little stick in there and stir it up every day and then cover it back up. And it would generate quite a bit of methane. You'd be really surprised. You set it out in the sun, it would really cook.
So I'm envisioning this drum, and you've got this copper tube coming off that carries the methane gas off the top and something at the side where you're throwing in whatever and sticking your stick in there and stirring it up, and then you put the cap back on.
That's a real basic, you know, that's a real basic methane generator. I know that in China, that some of the areas have methane generators built into their homes. It's more of a middle class kind of thing, I guess you'd call it. But they do it with, you know, with like clay. You can get clay from the surrounding area, and they dig a hole. They line the hole with clay. Then they take firewood and put it down in there and make a real hot fire so that they fire the clay. And then they fashion an opening out of wood, or it could even be flexible if you wanted to make it out of canvas or rubber or something like that, that would allow the gas to, you'd be able to see it inflate. And then they would just basically siphon it off. But that would also be connected to their indoor facilities where they could just constantly keep it going. And about halfway up on the inside of this pot would be maybe a 4-inch, you could even use like PVC or something, a 4-inch drain that would come off, and it would take the waste water out of the system and start keeping a level at a low level. Now, of course, every year or two, you'd have to get in there and dip some of that stuff out. That's the bad part. But that, too, would make excellent fertilizer. And if you leave it kind of spread out, you just don't take it out and just dump it on your plants. You've got to process that, too. You take that out and kind of put it in boxes and let it kind of cook in the sun and turn it over occasionally, because it's going to be real, real hot fertilizer, and you really don't want to put anything like that on your garden. You just let it cool down a little bit, and you can even add clippings or vegetable matter to it to kind of tone it down a little bit. And then in a year or so, it's perfect for the garden. You throw it in, and it's ready to go.
Yeah, interesting. Now, you said that the Chinese have like a piece of rubber or something that they can see that it's inflating, and they know that the methane gas has accumulated, and siphon it off. Well, does this mean that the methane cooker is like several feet away from maybe a stove that's going to use methane gas?
Let's just say it's pretty close to the house. You know, I don't think that the United States building code would kind of allow that sort of thing, you know, in the current situation. But if we were in an emergency situation, I, a lot of people would be dispersed and displaced. I don't think there's going to be a lot of building code in the aftertime.
So when you're cooking with methane gas, I know that for, and this is a little crude, but every once in a while there's a movie that shows teenagers or somebody farting and lighting their fart. You know, that methane gas can be explosive if it accumulates too much. So, but presumably if you don't have a huge accumulation and under pressure or whatever, so if you have this is tubing over and it's almost like the cooking stoves that work off of propane and the like, you turn a dial and light it, and now you have that fire in your stove. And as long as you're burning it off and it's not accumulating too much, then you're safe, right?
Oh, yeah. And actually, if somebody has planned, you know, pretty well in advance, they can take compressors and they can actually siphon off the methane, put it in little canisters, you know, kind of like you see with, you know, camping trailers or even the kind of things you use with your grill, the little 20-pounders. You could actually fill those up. Now, you're not going to get that much in them because you'd need a double or triple stage compressor to really get some high pressures in there, but you'd be able to do quite a bit. In a survival situation, that's what you need. You always need what you need when you need it.
That's
one of the things that could really come in handy.
Yep, it's a good cooking and heat, good light heat and the like. I would presume that since methane rises, that you could take it for cooking out of the top of the container and move it into the bottom, you know, if you're trying to fill the container, and that would work because it definitely rises. It's lighter than air, and it would be coming off the top, so to speak. Have you actually cooked with this stuff? I mean, have you actually tried that?
I guess about, 15 years ago, I made, you know, one of the 50-gallon can ones, 55-gallon can. It worked for quite a while. And I just had it hooked up to just a regular grill. It would sit there. I just kind of got bored with it after a while, and it fell in disuse. Had to get rid of it. You know, it was more of an experiment for me to see if it actually works.
Yeah. So what you did is you just had a tube coming out of the top and over to your cook stove, and you just kind of release a little valve that would let that gas flow, and same time you got the match over there, and boom.
Yeah, I had a little modification on my stove to make, but other than that, it was, I took I believe it was a quarter-inch copper tube and just ran it over to it. It was a little difficult for me to find the right fitting. Once I found the fitting, I got it hooked up, and everything was okay. I mean, it burned for quite a while. I could cook a full meal on it every day without a problem.
Holy cow. And you were just using yard clippings and chicken droppings and stuff like that, huh?
Yeah, actually, I was using cow manure and chicken droppings mostly, and a few things out of the garden, but not too much, because, you see, you have to process the vegetable matter a little bit. I mean, you can't just throw leaves and stuff right on in there. You got to chop it up. So you got to kind of shred things. You got to chop that up and throw it in there. Otherwise, you kind of clog the system.
Yeah.
So you have to kind of keep it in a slurry is what you really want, so it'll really cook.
Yeah.
Well, that's really the best way to do it.
When you consider in a survival community, one thing we're going to have for sure is what normally drops into the bottom of the outhouse. And if you can utilize that or the manure from your animals, then you've got a lot going.
Because
we produce, just think of it, every day. Otherwise than that, in waste treatment, in a normal situation where you have flush toilets and effluent goes down, survival communities are probably not going to have that unless they're just doing it in a stream and letting it go somewhere. In that case, there's a lot of stuff that will grow in wastewater, algae or other plants, you know, along the side, so that you actually end up cleaning the water by running it through. I know I've heard it said that oysters, for instance, bottom feeders, they clean the water as it goes across, and you can end up eating them afterwards. Kind of a yucky thought, but have you ever looked into any of that?
I was kind of into aquaculture there for a while. When I designed my underground home, that was part of my greenhouse led with it. And we were looking into, you know, spirulina and stuff like that as, you know, the blue-green algae as a protein source. how we were going to harvest that and how we could actually make enough of it to feed the 30 to 40 people that would be in this underground home. We was researching lots of different ways to do that. Mostly the aquaculture end of it, mainly we were just trying to do more of the fish kind of thing rather than oysters. And we really weren't trying to set up a full biome or anything like that. I guess just strictly grow the fish, eat the fish kind of thing.
Well, we had some fish tanks in a lab here for a while and tried to grow hydroponics in the fish water because when you think about it, the fish is pooing and peeing into their water, and we were able to grow something.
Oh, yeah.
in that it wasn't real dramatic like hydroponics. Our hydroponics did far better, and I was trying to do apples to apples, but did you have trouble with your spirulina? I know that blue-green algae is so healthy and has immune system boosters and the like, but it can get impurities, right?
That's one of the things that happened to us, and I think that our filtration system that we had wasn't adequate, and we lost basically the whole crop.
Of algae?
Yeah.
Although sometimes there are some fish that will eat algae, like I want to call them the tapioca fish, and I know that I'm mispronouncing the name.
Yeah, I know which one you're talking about.
Yeah, and they eat algae. They're vegetable eaters and grow very fast. So what kind of fish were you trying to raise there?
We were just using kind of standard things. We had bass, we had catfish, you know, had bluegill, some perch, and, you know, some trout. And they really didn't get along with each other that well. Mainly become kind of a feeding frenzy for the bass. Took advantage of their obvious attributes.
They're big and have teeth, huh?
Yeah, they're pretty hardy fish.
Yeah. So when you had the pond, how did you feed the fish? I mean, what did you put in there to feed them?
Well, at the time we were just using a standard, you know, fish food. In the after time, it's going to get kind of interesting how that's going to play out.
Yeah. We have a pond. Next door to, I own it. It's a wetlands, and it has a lot of duckweed on top of it. A lot of stuff to eat down there. Wild ducks come through, you know, sometimes Canadian geese and cranes, and they find a lot to eat down there, a lot of frogs and the like. But if you have something out in nature, a pond, it's likely that you can keep fish, and they'll find something to eat and the like. And I would imagine running a sewage effluent into that area, if you've got a lot of lush bulrushes and the like, as well as fish, it might actually increase the nutrient capacity that pond.
Yeah, it would. The thing is, though, you wouldn't want to do it directly. You would have to go to a settling pond, and that water that comes off the settling pond could possibly be diverted to do that.
Yeah.
You know, because you really wouldn't want it you know, too hot to get in there.
Yeah. Now, actually, settling ponds, and I'm no expert on it, but I know what I've seen, and they're just a series of ponds, and it comes out of the sewage, out of the toilet. And obviously, the heavy stuff settles, and the water flows over, and then there's a second pond, and
right.
It goes through the same process. And I think they also sometimes have paddles. I've seen paddles.
Yeah, the air.
Right, and they try to pull in by that oxygen or, you know, make sure that it, and then eventually after the fourth pond down or whatever, the water looks pretty clear and it goes back into the river or whatever. That's my impression of how that works. Yeah.
Yeah.
So you mentioned you built like an underground, designed.
Yeah, it's designed. I've got some people right now interested in building it. So I don't know how that's going to play out at the moment.
I actually had was thinking about that because when you mentioned that you had designed an underground home, when we have our foundations and homes, people like dig a hole. and then pour concrete or put down concrete blocks or something. The concrete blocks or reinforced concrete holds back the earth from actually like caving in the sides of the basement wall. Now, if you have an underground home, don't you have an awful lot of pressure on the walls, and do you have to build like reinforced concrete walls?
No, not really. You know, because basically what you would do is you would excavate a really big hole, and once you had it level at the bottom, you'd start your foundations. You would put any reinforcing or buttressing or anything like that in place prior to backfilling. So what you would do is, you know, just make sure your biggest worry is waterproofing, is make sure that you have adequate waterproofing around the entire area. I mean, I'm telling you, really go for the waterproofing, because that's going to be your big problem. In drainage, you have to make sure that the foundation is adequately drained, because you're not really going to be putting dirt right up against your walls. You're going to be putting gravel and other rock, and then you're going to be putting some of the fill dirt back in place, because you're going to need to have the water percolate from away from your building. And the only way you're going to do that is if you have adequate drainage system around the building. It's a really good idea to make sure that the waterproofing is really adequate. I can't stress that enough, because you really don't want to have to go back and do this a second time.
So choosing the site sounds like something you'd want to do carefully. In other words, if you looked at a hill and you said, okay, I'm going to build my underground home into the side of this hill, then you mostly would have to worry about drainage down from the top of the hill or around the sides. But let's say you were down pretty far down the side of the hill, down toward the valley, there you might really have a lot of underground water flowing past you. So do you have some advice about top of the hill, bottom of the hill, or what to look for, what might make a good drainage site versus, whoops, I'm in a mucky muck?
Yeah, well, given the possible problems with pole shift, I don't think being on a hill is going to be a good idea. I would plant myself, I wouldn't say down in a valley, but I would find an area that, if you were to go to the county and look up topographical maps, just take a look at the area you plan on building in. They have a lot of information on just exactly what the flow rates are, percolation, a bunch of different things. Any way or any place that you put this thing, it needs to be, because you can dig into the side of a hill and hit a spring. You can basically start digging, you know, a hole in the ground, and you're going to hit an underground river. Those are possibilities. The thing to do would be to, you're going to have to take a percolation test anyway and see just exactly, you know, what your area is made of, whether you've got bedrock, limestone, granite, whatever it is that's under you. Then you'll know where to build and how to build at that point. It even could dictate your design.
Right.
So you have to kind of, I want to say, go with nature kind of thing. Check out the area. If you want to do a thermal envelope home, that's cool. If you want to just do like an earth-sheltered berm type home, that'll work. Maybe even a kind of a half dome in the side of a hill. Those kinds of things would work. But then again, when pole shift comes along, will any of this stuff withstand any of it? It could get extremely serious very fast, and then you're trapped in something you don't want to be trapped in.
Right. When you said percolation test, how is that done? I mean, it's kind of like putting a pipe down 6 feet and seeing if it fills up.
Well, actually, they'll drill a number of holes, basically take a sample. You know how they cut through ice, get a sample of ice, and take it back to the lab?
Yeah.
They kind of do the same thing. But with the soil, and it tells them a lot about compaction, how the water is going to kind of trickle through, or whether it's going to run off. It'll tell them, you know, what the soil is made of, whether it's made of clay or some kind of loam, or, you know, there's a lot to that, and I'm no expert in percolation or anything like that, but I've had a number of them done at the places I've worked at, and I have gotten the results back. It's kind of interesting, you know, how much they can tell you about the ground around the area you plan to build.
Who do you send that to? Is that something that's done in the state?
A private company would do it, but typically if you're, you know, applying for a building permit through a county or a state, they're going to be interested in what your perk test says.
Ah, you know, I spent time in California, and they have landslides. And I remember reading a book about that, or an article saying that it's basically a clay layer with a more loamy type soil on top of it. What happens is that there's a big rainstorm. It can't penetrate the clay. It rides on the top of the clay, making it slippery.
Right.
And then the loamy soil on top of the clay layer is just kind of like sliding on wet ice. You know,
right.
There it goes. So if you understand what's underneath you, you can anticipate a landslide. So it sounds like if you've got clay layers, that the water would be riding on top of that and likely to enter your home instead of, you'd want that below you, not at the level of your walls. So you mentioned the point about not being trapped in a house during a pole shift. We are anticipating earthquakes as much as Richter 9, and depending on where you are, there's going to be jolts. If you're in an area that's wet and soggy soil, you're going to have a lot of liquefaction, which means jiggling back and forth until what happens is that buildings, they kind of settle into the soil. And I've seen a picture of a Japanese building in an earthquake. I think I got the book Peace of Mind in Earthquake Country when I was out in California. And it showed a Japanese building, maybe 10 stories high, kind of squarish, you know, rectangular or whatever, and tipping over on its side at a 45-degree angle because of liquefaction. What happened was that it started leaning, and that edge of the building began to dive down into the mushy soil almost like a wedge. And the weight of the building was pushing. So people were climbing out of the windows and walking down the side of the building because it was leaning at this 45-degree angle. So liquefaction can actually create almost like quicksand out of the soil underneath you.
That's a lot of energy it's trying to dissipate.
Right. So now, obviously, to not run into some trouble where you're going to be trapped underground, I've always thought the kind of hobbit houses that they show, you watch those movies about the hobbits, the ring and the like, the Fellowship of the Ring, rather, they're so cute. And they use earth around the sides and on the top to insulate, but they still have window spaces and they still have doors. And it's all kind of rounded, so liquefaction would be unlikely to happen because of the rounded shape, like a boat riding on water. If you have a rounded tube of some sort, you know, it would be likely to float on any kind of mush, quicksand mush that the ground might become. But at least you can get out if you're partially open to the... So in your design of these underground homes, I mean, was it like kind of... Most of the rooms had no windows, or did you try to hug the outside?
Well, my design that I had was basically a square and then another square in the middle of it. The middle square, the whole thing was 10,000 square feet, and the middle square was 5,000 square feet, and it was a greenhouse. There was also natural lighting that radiated out in all the rooms all around the perimeter. You know, it was built for worst-case scenario, it would be built for worst-case scenario. Its whole design was based on that. So, I mean, it would withstand a near miss from a nuclear weapon, tornadoes, hurricanes, and it wouldn't even touch it. We even had a design for an earthquake foundation that this thing would sit on that would ride it out. treatment. Basically, that's pouring about 4 foot thick concrete around the entire perimeter where the foundation sits, and setting the whole thing on springs. Then that way, any shocks would be absorbed. Not only the really major, something major in the area would be about the only thing that would hurt it.
Interesting. That's another parallel to what I was able to observe in California when they were retrofitting some of these older buildings around San Francisco. One method they used was I can't just raise the whole darn thing up and put rollers under the foundation. I have this in my head that that's what they did, because that's what they said they did in writing, but I can't quite visualize it. But nevertheless, the idea
was... they did that to do the sideways motion, the shear.
Right.
And that's only if the shear is working in the way that the rollers are pointing.
If you get vertical, and then it doesn't account for everything, because a lot of earthquakes are vertical jerks and not side to side, and the best laid plans in Japan and California are always being
discovered. Well, I actually didn't come up with the idea of the springs. You know, I noticed in some of the designs they used in Cheyenne Mountain and NORAD, some of their stuff that they had in there was set on springs. And, you're talking pretty hefty springs.
Yeah.
You know, but it was able to withstand, quite a bit of shock.
Yeah, so the whole house was basically...
Right.
You had a concrete foundation with springs, and then you had another concrete house sitting on top of those springs.
Right.
And, wow. You were planning, basically, indoor lighting that you would generate. You would have generators of some sort, and you weren't using skylights for light, or...
No skylights. The only light would be through the greenhouse. Otherwise, you would have... The building had 9 different power systems. It was kind of a redundant thing. There was one particular one. The main power system was an Ormat Rankine cycle refrigerant-powered turbine generator. That would be used mainly to power the house. The way that it works is it has like these salt ponds that would collect heat, and you would basically pump the hot salt water in through a coil, which would heat up a refrigerant and, of course, raise its pressure. And then you would release that pressure into a turbine, start the generator, and then you would take colder water from another pond and put it through the evaporator, which would condense the refrigerant back down to a liquid state, and then you'd shoot it back over to the condenser side again. And this cycle would continue over and over. It's kind of a closed loop.
So am I hearing right that your fuel basically is salt water and cool water, but you can reuse the salt water and reuse the cool water?
Yeah, it's all reusable.
So you're generating heat from this, is that correct?
Technically, all you need is hot water.
Uh-huh.
If you could heat up 500 gallons of hot water, that would work, to do the same thing.
And your output is, am I right, heat?
No, your output would be electricity.
Oh, really?
Yeah, ready to go.
So if you have a hot water, that sounds like something somebody living in a geothermal environment might use.
That would be ideal.
Yeah.
Because then you really wouldn't have to worry about the solar aspects of it.
Right. There are places in Idaho, I think, where they have hot springs and the like and that kind of thing, that you're generating electricity from your hot water. So what was some of the other mechanisms for making light or making electricity that you had designed in?
Well, we had aerogenerators, of course. I mean, everybody should have one of those.
What's their fuel?
Just wind.
Oh, wind. Ah, yes.
Yeah.
Right, a windmill.
Yeah,
right.
Big windmill.
Yeah.
And there's various designs. You can make one out of stuff you find in a junkyard pretty easy.
If you were to make one out of stuff you find in the junkyard, where would those plans be? How would somebody go about looking at some plans for... We have some of that stuff on the Troubled Time site. There was one submitted by somebody in Sweden and said you can carve these blades out of wood and how to go about it. You know, the relative lengths and widths and pitch of the, blades.
Sure.
And the like. And that's available. And I know that there are on the internet some plans that people can go and get of how to make homemade windmills. I've also heard it said that something as simple as a lawnmower that has blades whirring could theoretically be rigged to become a windmill, you know, and be the turning power for a generator that would generate electricity.
Well, I haven't heard that one. Okay, but I do know about lawnmowers being used for lots of things, like arc welders and things like that. But one of the other things that was a wood gasifier. Have you made anything like that?
Well, you know, in the troubled times, we had some plans from Finland. A guy by the name of Ali got as a gift an old Volvo, and it was rigged with a wood gas burner on the back, and came with the plans, and which he provided, scanned and provided, and we got the gifts out there. It's also on those Trouble Times CDs that people can get for like $4.10 for a twin set, so that they could pull it up on a laptop, you know, if they didn't have a paper copy, and it ran, and he said you put in wood chips, you have to worry about it getting clogged up with tar, and we heard at that time also from people in Australia that said, well, in the outback, that's what they use when they have, like, electrical failures and the like, or gas delivery problems, or
right.
I don't know what, that their emergency defense still has wood gas-capable engines. And in Finland and Europe, they were running them for a long time after World War II when there was a gasoline shortage, and they had to use that, apparently, during the war. So wood gas works. And
yeah, well, one way to take the impurities out of that is, besides just taking the gas straight off of the generator, you need to run it through a condenser. And you fill the condenser with steel wool. And it takes a lot of that tar and acids and things like that out of it before it hits the engine.
Yeah, it's interesting. And actually, from what I've read and from what he had in the plans on how this works, a regular car engine can be modified, you know, to actually work with wood gas. You don't have to have any kind of a special engine.
Right.
You're really putting the wood gas in there, and it's firing just like you would if there was gasoline or ethanol, et cetera,
right.
Diesel, I'm presuming, same concept. So the main thing that I remember was that you had to get a fire going to begin with, and then you kept adding, you'd throw in a few chips. I guess you'd like tool down the road and then stop and throw some more wood chips in and then tool down some more, and you'd figure out how often you had to do that, maybe if your car started sputtering. And they thought they got some pretty good mileage, too. Like they could get it up to, I think, 60 miles an hour.
Yeah, you're not going to be passing anybody. You know, but you're definitely moving down the road.
Yeah, and not on your foot.
That's right.
Maybe not on foot either, yeah. You said that you could use lawnmower to act as an arc welder. Can you describe how that's done?
Well, basically you're going to have your hot lead coming off, and you're going to have a negative lead. You're just going to, I mean, that's typically what an arc welder is. It's just, you know, a lot of voltage on one side, and you're going to have some sort of medium that you're going to be welding with. And you kind of want it to be similar, a similar metal, not necessarily exact same metal, but you'd hold it on your positive side, or you could even do it on your negative side. But anyway, you're going to have to make a connection with that circuit. At the point that you're going to make that connection is where you're going to get your arc.
So you're twirling the blades of the lawnmower.
Now the blades are gone.
Uh-huh.
Blades are gone. You've got a pulley on there.
Uh-huh.
Okay. You've got a little belt that's going to the pulley of your alternator.
Uh-huh.
Okay. The alternator is fastened on the top there, you know, where the grass shoots out.
Right.
Right there. Now you have yourself a portable generator.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Yeah.
you can't really use this thing for a prolonged period if you're going to burn it out. You can do it for short welds and that kind of thing.
So
otherwise, you're going to have to do the old blacksmith method.
Right.
You know, heat it up, pound it together, that kind of thing.
But in order to turn it with a pulley, you've got somebody pumping on a bike or turning a crank or something, right?
Well, you're probably going to have your gasoline-powered, maybe not even gasoline-powered, but your gas engine running, which could be on methane or even a wood gas.
Uh-huh.
In the aftertime, you're going to have to get real creative. And see, that's the one thing I think is going to really make people really look at all the stuff that's around them. Is when they start getting into desperate straits, all of a sudden, everyone is going to be an inventor.
That's right.
And everyone is going to be looking at different ways to do things. They're going to come up with some pretty neat stuff.
Yeah, excellent point. There was something, a documentary on Cuba recently on TV, and it was fascinating to watch because they're poor. They've been under this embargo for so long, being the communist country or whatever. And they had devised ways to use a regular bike that you would pedal and make a motorbike out of it so that they got, I don't know, how many hundreds of miles practically out of a gallon of gasoline. And they rigged it from junk. And
oh,
then
yeah.
They had people that did this for a livelihood, you know, took bikes and took the junk and created a motorbike out of a pedal bike that would go phenomenally far on very little gasoline. So it was the creativity of the people that was so fascinating to watch.
Yeah, and people will actually think of different things to do because, gee, you don't have video anymore.
Yeah.
Well, maybe
right.
Some people do, but most people are not going to have the luxuries of that they once enjoyed. And so it's going to get kind of boring.
But actually, it's fun to be resourceful like that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. It's great to have you on for this hour, Tim, because you're describing things you've tried, you know, that you've not only thought about things that you'd like to do that you're not able to do yet or haven't been able to practice, put into practice, but so many of these little things you have tried, you've tinkered and discovered what worked and what didn't work. So let me ask you this. What have you tried to do that was a bomb? That didn't work, that you thought would?
Oh, boy.
Maybe nothing, huh?
Well, my first attempt at a wood gasifier didn't work out too good.
Ah. What went wrong?
I'm not sure. But I think I didn't do my air right. You know, down at the bottom, the way I was constructing mine was I used an old hot water heater.
Uh-huh.
And I cut the ends off of it, so basically I had a big tube. And then I welded, some 14-inch wheels, you know, off an old Datsun.
Uh-huh.
And the one on the bottom was also where I had taken a sheet metal plate and put a little spring, with some, wing nuts, little wing nuts on there. And I never could get that air to adjust right. That didn't work out too good. But I modified the design later and was able to do some things with that. You know, one of my earlier attempts at some solar experiments, because I did a lot of work with tracking solar reflectors and things when I was in college. It was one of my major projects that I did. I really messed up with the heat exchanger on that one. Well, it still worked, but I didn't get the heat transfer ratio right.
Yeah. But, you know, you learn from that, and then you take that. I think there's very few successes that don't have a lot of bumbling around behind them. Well, we had the labs for the nonprofit. I had them in my basement, and we had fish tanks. We were trying to see synergy between hydroponics and growing plants and the fish effluent and the like. We kept finding these catfish going belly up, and finally month later, somebody on the team who understood aquaponics said he figured it out. It was, we were using cow watering tanks were galvanized iron, and he said, "Ah, they leach
the
iron.
Zinc out of-
I think it was zinc, not the iron. Pardon me, it was the zinc, and which is fatal to fish. And it was a closed cycle, so it accumulated. So live and learn. But one of the other things we had real success on was doing hydroponics with. We had worm beds, a lot of compost with the worms in it, and they would have, like, their egg casts are excellent fertilizer, and you can just water these worm beds and collect what comes out. We made our own homemade hydroponic solution, which did as well as store-bought stuff. Everybody was saying, well, how do you make this nutrient solution? Guess what? You water your worm beds. So a fella in Perth, Australia, was doing this and selling these worm beds around Indonesia for people that had, like, hothouses or, you know, where they grow flowers or the like. It made the best fertilizer, and they just water these worm beds and collect what drains out, and that was the best liquid fertilizer you could get.
Oh, yeah.
So, but we made a mistake. We assumed that earthworms needed dirt, so we filled up their beds with dirt and just put composting on top, saying, okay, they come up at night and they eat. Well, not so, he said. That, and we were looking for the big harvest of earthworms, and we weren't getting it. He said, well, you don't put dirt in there. You put a lot of compost from the garden, you know, chipped up, and you keep turning it, and so that they just crawl around in there all the time. And that, then they, you get a huge population. Then what you do is you pick out the calf, because if you have too many egg casts, it's like automatic population control, which we didn't know, that we're retarding the they keep making egg casts and making babies if they think there aren't any babies around. You know, but if they have egg casts around, they say, whoa, population control. So we were doing two things wrong. We were putting dirt in instead of just compost. We weren't picking out the egg casts. But one thing we did right was learn that this we could make our own hydroponic solution. And it turned out in researching the web, nobody else around the world was doing this. Or haven't even thought of it, and we even wrote to hydroponic companies, and they said, oh, that doesn't work. You have to buy our nutrient solution. So we learned something brilliant and made some bumbling mistakes, but you know, unless we had made those mistakes, I wouldn't have learned that, because if it was just theory, we would have put down, okay, you know, this isn't the soil, blah, blah, blah. And not learned our lesson. It wasn't until we didn't get our results and I started trying to research why that we realized what we should be doing. So
right.
You have to actually make a mistake.
Oh, yeah, it's perseverance.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. For your underground housing, did you actually try to get a group interested and found that the group dynamic kind of fell apart if you didn't have a disaster immediately, you know, or imminent, that you really didn't get cooperation? The reason I'm bringing that up is I've talked to an awful lot of people who are looking at the earth changes and saying, something's coming, something terrible is coming, and I feel it in my bones. I know they take the earth changes very seriously. And they want to be with other people. They want to get a group going. And frequently they do get a group going, and then it falls apart. And the group dynamic seemed to be that you have to have a foot in today's world or in the other world, in the future. And if people want to live in today's world, they're expecting paychecks and, you know, a real clean house and, you know, all the things that people anticipate for living in today's world. But if you're going to plan for the future when things are going to be falling apart and everybody has to be cooperative or nobody eats, it runs amok. In other words, these two lifestyles bump into each other. And you can't really get cooperation from people until things start to go amok. Have you found that to be true?
Oh, that's absolutely true. And, you know, the thing is that, you know, the choice you have to make, if you're getting a group together, you have to make sure that everyone in that group has the same, well, not strictly the same, but the same viewpoint on the way things need to run and the way things are going to run. It's always good to even have your so-called government in waiting, ready to take over when the time is right. If you do have a facility already built and you do have a number of people that are supposedly on board with you, then you definitely need to make sure that everybody that's associated with this facility is speaking the same language. Everybody is heading in the same direction. Because if you have even one dissenter in the whole thing, it's going to be a poison that's going to permeate the entire society. It's going to be a problem. And it's going to happen because people are going to look back on the way things were. They're going to want things the way they were. They maybe even think that things should be that way now. There's a really serious psychological, I don't know what you would call it. It's more of a psychological push that people are going to try to relive the good old days. The good old days aren't there no more. Now you have to, it's going to be a struggle to survive day to day. And if you're not on board with that, then there's going to be a problem. If somebody is not doing their fair share, then the big question is, do they get fed that day? I mean, there's a lot of interaction. There's going to be a lot of dynamic going on. And then what do the kids do? Are the kids just going to be sitting there playing all day long, or are they going to be doing some work too? Or we do have to continue education. These kids are going to be the next generation that's going to have to learn something. They're going to take over. So they have to learn everything that we know, just so that they'll survive through the next generation. And there's a lot to that. And people really, even in the survival groups, I really don't think are thinking along those lines. Now, a lot of people that are already homeschooling are very well aware of that. And they're already into, you know, different ways of education and things like that.
Right.
And that's going to be a big, big move. You've probably even seen a kind of a huge push toward homeschooling across the nation.
Yeah, there has been that big push.
Yeah.
Right, exactly. And I've often thought that, to some degree, children will be learning at their parents' knee. Now, let's say the parents are busy. You know, they're either, mending clothes or weeding the garden or, whatever they're doing. Or in the case, maybe daddy is sitting down and looking at the junk and putting together some rig that'll do thus and so. And the kid comes up. Now, what usually happens is children come up and say, "What are you doing?" And the parent says, "Go away, you know, go watch TV or go play because I'm busy. I don't want you underfoot." You know, my father was great that way. Whatever he would work down in his woodworking in the basement, or if he was going fishing or doing, he'd have me with him. My brother and sister also, you know, could go, but it was always me. I was always tagging along like a little tomboy, and he would let me do what he was doing. He would find something I could do to help, but the main thing, I noticed what he was doing. I noticed how he went about it. He would talk to me about what he was trying to achieve. And I watched this in the village where I am now. There are a couple of men who work. One is a tree cutter who climbs up in trees and tops them and takes them down, tricky things. He swings around up there like Tarzan. And if his children aren't in school, they're with him. And they're doing things. I mean, they're not dangerous, but they're hauling away trash, and they're seeing how he plots and plans what he's doing, like learning the trade at his knee. And the maintenance guy in the village also takes his child along. Bright kid, probably knows more about pumps and sewage and how things fit together than most adults, just from being with his dad. And so at the parent's knee is one thing that will happen to some degree. I definitely think children should be involved and be active.
Absolutely.
Give them and put them in charge.
Yeah.
I thought about, okay, if, let's say, the pole shift was going to hit the village here, and what I would do, I would try to say afterwards, okay, now all the teenagers should go and find any cow with a broken leg that's going to have to be put to sleep, and so-and-so dig a pit, and we're going to have a barbecue, and for the first night after the pole shift, we're going to have barbecue with these, right? So, in other words, you get everybody, and the girls go find the mattress, get them out of the rain, put them under, find some rooftop or lean-to that you can put the mattress under so we have dry mattresses for people to sleep on, and make it kind of like a project, kind of like fun, that they can lead a project, because children really want to be involved. So, there was one instance, somebody that bought some land, got a composting toilet, you know, brought electricity into the land for the time being, and was looking around for other people that might be of a like mind, pole shifter, as she called it. Now, she found a family, this was in the Appalachian Mountains somewhere, that the woman knew herbal meds, the father was very handy, carpentry and the like, they did their own midwifing, understood chickens and pigs and goats, and said, oh, good, you know, come live on my land, and we'll team up. And the guy wanted to be paid a salary because he had one foot in today. So it didn't work out for that reason. She was saying, no, no, wait, we're living like a pole shift is about to happen. And he's saying, no, but it didn't happen, and I got to live today. And it also, and that's one example of...
Well, it's good it didn't happen. You know, I mean, because these things are going to fit.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the right person at the right time, the right place.
That's right.
You know, it's going to come together. Now, there's more to it than just us.
Right. Oh, I quite agree. And you're going, you know, people are going to be guided. And another combination that I thought would be excellent would be older couples on a farm, small farm. They can't run their farm anymore. They you know, so they just live in there. But they got the barn, and they could have, you know, livestock and chickens and the like. They could have, maybe somebody's tilling their fields and they're renting their fields out. But basically the farm's inactive because they're old. And here comes a kid's college age, maybe, or a family with young children. And they've got the energy where the old folks didn't. But the old folks have the knowledge. And maybe they got some old tools in those barns, you know, like cross-cut saws and hand tools, things like that. So that's a winning combination that could come together, but it's unlikely to come together until a little closer to the time when it's going to happen, you know, when the earth changes are really picking up steam.
Hello, I'm Roger, president of Troubled Times Incorporated. We're a nonprofit organization dedicated to helping mankind survive during troubled times when self-sufficiency may be the only answer. Our organization offers a twin set CD of survival information at cost to the public. The CDs are in hypertext and PDF format, two popular browser formats, and contain all the information collected by the massive Troubled Times website. The CDs allow you to browse this information offline at your leisure. The cost of the twinned pair is $4.10, and this includes postage. You can also get the survival booklet, a hip-sized booklet of the gist of the Troubled Times advice, for just $5, including postage. We offer a popular combo package for $7.50 that includes both the CDs and the booklet, with the lower postage expense reflected in that price. Send for your copies today to start making practical plans for your and your family's survival. Just click on the $4.10 CD link at www.zetatalk.com, and your copy will be on its way.
That concludes our broadcast. Thank you for being with us. Remember to carry love in your heart. It's the commodity of the future. As the Zetas say, love may have a blooming going into the shift, as it ought, those with great love in their hearts responding to the realization that little else matters.